She didn't even went a long way to get to taking care of business. That was a lot of runway there, by the way. The theme song, Taking Care of Business, is for our guest, Alan Hall. Please join me in welcoming Alan. Hey, Alan.
Oh, Steve, what a pleasure to be with you today.
I know. This is. Have you ever been introduced with the theme song, Taking Care of Business?
No, but now I'm going to make it my theme song.
It should go on your voicemail and everything else.
I think it should be.
Let me give you a formal introduction. Entrepreneur, angel investor, venture capitalist, author, philanthropist, and you're also in town this week. We're recording this early in the week, but a little bit later on, you are giving the keynote for the Maine Real Estate and Development Association, MERADA, and you'll be talking about economic development, some of your perspective from your business life, and also your thoughts on how maybe Utah's economy, which is known for being relatively vibrant, compares to Maine. Can't wait to get into that. But before we do, why don't we talk a little bit about your background, your early years, and then we'll talk about what you've come to Maine for.
Well, Steve, again, it's a pleasure to be here. My background is I graduated with a master's degree back in 1972 from Brigham Young University.
Fantastic.
Graduated in psychology undergraduate, and then my wife and I served in the United States Peace Corps. Lived in the jungles of Bahia, Brazil, in a little adobe hut.
Talk a little bit, I don't want to derail the conversation, but the Peace Corps is such a fascinating thing to me. For people that may be listening that are familiar with kind of the reference Peace Corps, talk a little bit how you decided to join the Peace Corps and really what their mission was there and the kind of great work they're doing today.
Well, we joined in 1969, just as we were graduating from the university, and I wanted a little break between that undergraduate program and then into a graduate program. And we looked around and thought, you know, this was the Kennedy program.
Right.
And we thought, you know, I speak Spanish. I'd been a Mormon missionary in Guatemala, so I could speak Spanish. So I said, you know, to my wife, let's do something wild. Let's just go on a Peace Corps. So we learned Portuguese, and off we went. It was kind of a year adventure. We were newly meds. Well, where else are you going to start your wife where she makes 11 cents an hour?
If you're going to check compatibility, going through that experience would certainly test the relationship, wouldn't
it? I think it does. And, you know, you start them at such a low wage, everything's up from there. So
perfect. So how did you go from between Brigham Young and then your service and Peace Corps, how did that lead to all of your business accomplishment and kind of a community accomplishment?
I knew I was an entrepreneur, but back in my graduate school days, you were sort of looked down on. Academia did not consider entrepreneurship a value. You should go to work for Procter & Gamble. You should get a real job, Alan.
Yeah, I don't even remember the term entrepreneurship even being part of the vernacular back then.
No, it certainly wasn't taught, but I knew I was. It was just deep down inside of me. So I sort of had day jobs. And I wanted to be involved in leadership early on, so I took jobs where I could get to the top quickly. But at night and on the weekends, I tried my entrepreneurial things. I had four lovely failures, lost my shirt.
Everyone talks about that. Many successful business people I've talked to, and obviously the books, talk about the value of failure being almost as significant as success.
It's expensive. I could have gone to Harvard four or five times based on what I learned. But you'd ask yourself, why'd this guy lose four times? It was the same thing every time. I didn't listen to my customer first before I built a product. I eventually figured it out, and MarketStar, a global marketing sales company, became that. But it took me a while to figure out really how to start and grow a business.
So that was your first big business success, MarketStar.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk briefly about what was the type of business and what really led to the success that led to, I guess, you selling it to the wonderful organization of Omnicom?
I had a business that failed, and I had a new product to take to market, and I couldn't find anybody to do it. I needed to go out and evangelize this technology product. And I tried a number of things, and finally I settled on hiring some college kids. Sent them across the country to go out and talk to resellers, to retailers about this technology product. But the company failed. But coming out of that, I thought, I needed that product. I wonder how many other small startups need what I have. And so with the launch of Windows back then out of Microsoft, there were a lot of little startups that had the same need. And lo and behold, I started a company called TempReps, Temporary Representatives. And TimeNet became Technology Advancement Corporation. And in time, that became MarketStar, and so it grew over the last 26 years to have 6,000 employees doing global business and doing it about $8 billion in sales for these large customer. So,
it evolved based on the customer need. So is the name changed? It was probably more than the name, right? It was the focus of the business.
It was. We kept refining it and finally realized that, you know what? We can do washers and dryers in addition to some sort of a computer for HP. So that kind of was the precedent for changing the name. And so I learned over those many years, this is how it works and how we got to be big and grew because we listened to customers.
Fantastic story. So once MarketStar reached its potential, and I believe you're still involved as the chairman.
Correct.
And so as day-to-day as CEO, but you're still involved as one of the legacy leaders. How did that lead you into other features of your career, whether it's being a columnist for Forbes.com or you've contributed to Harvard Business Review and also Grow America? And talk about how your career path brought you here today and ultimately how you're appearing at Mareda talking about some of these principles to different business leaders in Maine.
Well, to answer your question succinctly, I decided at that point in time that I'd make sure my wife, because we sold the business to Omnicom at that point in time and did well, and I said, I'm going to give my wife some cash so she never has to worry about her riverboat gambler husband again.
The entrepreneur in you knew that as an entrepreneur, you may have just, put it back into something else, right? So you wanted to take some money off the table.
That's right. Took some money off the table, made sure that wife wasn't worried about where the next check was coming from. Then we took the rest, and we decided to give it away. So we created a foundation to help the needy in our part of Utah. And then I said, I need to help other entrepreneurs do the same thing. So I'm going to take cash and become an angel investor, a venture capitalist, and help other companies grow and hire employees. Well, what I found through that experience then is I've learned a lot about doing due diligence on companies, finding the right ones, picking the right ones, seeing the failures, understanding what goes on, and helping them grow their businesses. And so now I'm all about giving back, whether it's money or time or talent. It's to help people worldwide in terms of economics.
Fantastic. This will air on the weekend, a few days after your appearance at Mareda, since we're taping it early. When you give these talks around the country and you write for business magazines and periodicals, what type of practical advice do you think is most effective? And what will you be talking about here in Maine to different policy leaders, political leaders, local entrepreneurs? Actionable advice, because there's an entire, I almost call it a cottage industry, but it's more like a mansion industry of business advice. And my library is full of books, and in the spirit of full disclosure here, by the way, we have Alan Hall. He's an entrepreneur. He's a thought leader involved with business. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O and News Talk WLOB 1310. I generally, and I need you to either validate this or be critical of this on the air, I generally look at what I think Warren Buffett would do. And I grew up in an era where we've done a lot of work with Walmart and Sam Walton, who had that same kind of folksy charm where Warren Buffett, goes on CNBC or any of these business shows, and he's like, I went to Dairy Queen, and I like the ice cream, and I thought, hey, they've got good management, I'm going to buy them, or I'm going to hold on to Coca-Cola, or I'm going to buy a railway system because railway's so important. And it's so folksy, and it's so on target, whereas in the next minute, you have these four or five guys with these bright ties and these fancy suits telling you about double reverse, emerging markets, sell the bond, the commodity. So my business philosophy is simply, what would Warren do? If you wouldn't mind sharing yours a little bit and what you're here in Maine talking about and how that may compare to what Warren would do.
Well, the reason I'm here is I was invited by the Mareda people because I wrote an article in Forbes why Utah is the number one state in the country for business. And I find out they're 50th. So out of all the states, Maine is the worst of all of them.
Right.
So the leadership said, well, come out here and tell us what you're doing. What are the practical things that you're doing that maybe we ought to consider? So we're really looking at this, back to your point of something that's practical, is it's really saying to the leaders of the state, you got a problem, fix it. Get in a room together, cooperate, don't worry about politics, work for the common good of your people to make this economy work. And ladies and gentlemen, you can go do that if you put your heads and minds and hearts together.
Well, can you preview a little bit of what the practical advice would be for Maine? My guess is, since you anticipated coming here for some time when they invited you, you've probably done a little research, and being a thoughtful, accomplished business person, you looked at some of the quantitative and qualitative issues involving Maine. What could you share with us today that some observations you've made coming from a state that has been recognized as being high performing with economics, and what are some things that you think Maine should at least be aware of or sensitive to, if not out-and-out change?
My sense is, Steve, is that the state isn't business-friendly today. They have taxes and regulations that are onerous. For example, 15% maybe on corporate taxes, and a whole slew of bureaucratic regulations you have to go through to even start a business. So that tells outsiders, wait a minute, why should we go here? Let's find another place. In contrast, Utah has a corporate tax of 5% and has had that for 15 years.
Mm.
And you can start a business tomorrow in Utah just by signing up. So you start to see that there's some fundamentals at the highest level that government has to have right in order to invite and grow the local talent. That make sense?
Makes perfect sense.
So I'm saying to the local leaders, government and civic, why don't you, ladies and gentlemen, fix that? Don't just tell people this is the place to do business. Mean it and put some things in a place that will attract people with corporate support coming in to take the advantage of those opportunities financially.
I agree. One of the things that I talk about frequently is, I think everyone's familiar with the term economic development, but in the political realm, I'm not sure if we have enough elected leaders that not only understand the term, but the application. And to me, economic development relative to whether it's U.S. economic development in the world stage or here in Maine as we compete globally, you know, across the street from where we're located, there's a bakery, European bakery, lovely red velvet cupcakes. Right, Shani? Don't you love those cupcakes?
Agreed.
Right. I can't afford many of them. They're very, very, being a European bakery, you know, I think the ingredients are flown specially from Europe. But if there's a $5 red velvet cupcake and I go over there and take $5 out of my pocket and give it to the European bakery cupcake person, and then I come back and eat the cupcake, delicious, by the way, we're not doing much economic development. We're transferring something out of my pocket into a local business. Conversely, if you have a business that brings in millions of dollars of outside capital investment from national, international companies, let's say in the case of here, this organization, and then I'm able to pay people, invest in buildings, pay property taxes, excise taxes, the money coming in from the outside has a more positive effect than regenerating capital within a state. And I think in the case of Maine, most of the people who are leaders of the state don't really differentiate between shifting economic prosperity from one neighborhood to another and shifting dollars from one local place to another. Unless you're bringing in expansion and capital from outside, you're diminishing the capital, because when you send federal taxes out, sooner or later you run out of all the capital.
Well, you're spot on. What, you have a net zero-sum game, don't you?
Right.
Nothing really moved in any direction.
Yeah.
So your idea is really threefold the way we look at it. Startup businesses, something new with products and services to sell. That's one way to start the thing going. Attract new businesses, large businesses here, or figure out a way to grow the existing business base. That takes time. Entrepreneurship takes time. The key thing is to bring companies here. And they come here because it's economically feasible and fits their model.
Right. Well, I have a theory. And again, the folks at Forbes, they constantly review whether or not I should be allowed to subscribe to Forbes, never mind write for it. So as you're a writer for Forbes, I want to try out my theory on you. My theory in terms of Maine's economic challenges, and this is also relative to Utah, which I do think has had some great success, is based on physics, based on time, space, speed. Maine is one of the first settled colonies states. Maine has about 35,200 square miles, right? So we're a huge state. You could put the other four New England states into Maine and still have room left over for a big parking lot. So we're this huge state. And 200 years ago, when Maine was first settled, the people spread out all over the place. You know, after the Civil War, there were land grants. The government didn't have money, so people had land grants all over the place. We have 488 municipalities, 16 counties, 1.3 million people. But we have infrastructure across the state that could support 8 million people. But we have 1.3 million. And one of the challenges I believe we have in the state is that we have, it's not just administrative efficiency. We have a physical platform that's inefficient in the new economy, the newer economy that we're participating in. Because back when there was a, you know, there was the timber and the textile economy here in Maine, which were traditional economies. New economy demands speed, efficiency, right? And the further we move people away from healthcare and education and jobs, the less efficient we become. And in order to sustain that enormous infrastructure, Maine, through years and years of policy, more like apathy, have kept raising these tax hurdles, these economic barriers to outside money. I believe the answer for Maine is to address the physical nature of our state and recognize that we cannot, over 35,000 square miles, attempt to provide first-class healthcare, education, jobs, and everything else. There's too much physical space. And my final piece of evidence relative to Utah is Utah has approximately 2.9 million people, and approximately 80% live along the Wasatch Front, centering on Salt Lake City, leaving vast expanses of the state nearly uninhabited. So as other states like Utah were settled, whether it was based on railway settlement or with natural resources, there were more dense clusters. And so Utah has critical mass in some of your economic zones that we don't have here in Maine. Does that resonate? Because I think the point you made was excellent in terms of development, but a lot of it has to do with we need to re-engineer our state, is my belief.
Well, I think you're making a great philosophical statement about what has to change. Now, you know, accomplishing that will be an interesting debate, will it not? But you're right. Utah happens to have this population center, and most of the average age of our citizen is 29.
Right.
Highly educated. We speak 170 languages. So we can attract people into this corridor where there's a lot of people.
And you have critical mass. So healthcare becomes more efficient. Education becomes more efficient.
That's
and
right.
You have a pool of skilled labor that's attractive for companies.
That's exactly right. You've summarized exactly what's going on in the state of Utah.
But we need to work together over the next 15 minutes. By the way, we have Alan Hall here in the studio. He is from Utah. He's speaking this week at Mareda in talking about economic opportunity and development. He has been a CEO and chairman of businesses, and he is also a contributor to Forbes. So talk a little bit about, you know, as you're speaking to the folks at the event this week, the challenge I have had, and this is a challenge that the burden is mine, but I want to share it with you, is that in a very provincial state like Maine, we have deep roots. And part of that is great. Part of that is the warmth and the wonder that is Maine. Nostalgia is one of our greatest exports, right? But in the new economy, companies and new money and capital isn't very nostalgic. It's very pragmatic. And so if we want outside companies to invest, they're not caring very much about the good old days. They could invest in Ireland. They could invest in Iowa. They could invest in Utah. Money goes, much like energy, where there's least resistance and there's most attraction. How would you recommend, based on your business experience, that Maine becomes more attractive for outside capital, given the challenges we have with infrastructure?
So let's talk back to fundamentals for a moment. The owner of a business, the CEO, has three objectives. One is to increase revenues. They have to, or they go out of business. They want to increase the gross margins on those revenues. They want to reduce their costs, which will provide them with more profit. They have to have profit to grow, and they have to be innovative. They've got to be changing the way they do business every day, listening to their customer. Now you look at the state of Maine and the parties that be, and if they said to themselves, we're going to listen to our customer, what do we have to do that would be true to help those leaders of those businesses do those same things. More revenue, more margin, less cost, and therefore they'll make a profit. Well, a lot of that then has to do with the way that we're set up right now. So let's say, Steve, you and I were now in charge of Maine. And we said, let's...
I ran for governor, and it didn't work out so well. This guy named Mike Michu, who, by the way, I greatly respect, he's now running for governor, Democrat. But, yeah, the whole idea of running Maine has some appeal even before this interview.
Oh, well, yeah, so we're going to go back to that.
We're going to go back to those times. Okay.
It's back to those times. So you and I sit in a room, and there's a big whiteboard.
Right.
And we say, let's make Maine number one. What would we have to do? Because we have to attract these companies that are coming our way. We want them here, and we also want to take care of the ones that are here.
Right.
What are we going to have to do? How do we generate this more revenue? How do we make their margins increase? And where do we cut their costs? Right now, Maine is doing the opposite things for a CEO of why they would come here.
That's also a challenge in government, because whether it's in the local level, the state level, and the national level, there is always this debate on should government be run like a company, and you use the vernacular CEO. I believe that part of it does. Yeah, if you're the governor of Maine, you have to function as both the chief executive. Also, there's other roles as far as chief cheerleader and civic, you know, supporter. But if the economics, if the math isn't working, then you can be the friendliest governor or the happiest person in the world, but everything else will be subordinate to that. You know, healthcare, education, public services, if the economics of the state aren't working. So to that end, I do think we need more philosophy of a CEO.
Well, let me give it in a kind of a business setting again, and hope your listeners will agree with us. Is think of the voters as basically the owners of the business.
Right.
They're the shareholders of the state, right?
Yeah.
And they turn and invest their money through taxes into a governor and a legislature. Those people are hired by the people.
Senior executives.
Right?
Right. Yep.
Senior executives. They have a budget. They should turn and maximize those resources, those dollars they've got, for an outcome that comes back to benefit and bless those shareholders. And with politicians thinking that way, they ought to be looking every day. Are we spending our money wisely in healthcare? What are we doing about infrastructure? What are we going to do about growth?
Well, let's stay on that thought a little bit, Alan. You talked about voters being the shareholders or stockholders. Do we have shareholders and stockholders now across the country, here in Maine, here in Utah, that are engaged and informed enough that they can play that role? Because that's part of the mix. My other hypothesis that I'll share with you is over the last 50 years, there has been some decay of our democracy born from many voters, either through frustration with the system, or there's other variables ranging from abject narcissism to other more natural phenomena. If we don't have people active, learning about the issues, learning about the candidates, is an example in Minnesota about, I don't know, it's 10 or 15 years ago, they elected Jesse Ventura. Mm-hmm. They elected a wrestler, a worldwide wrestler, as governor. Who does that unless you're just joking around? And they have a multi-billion dollar budget. And we see that on different levels, you know, local, county, and state government. And if that's happening, do you think that some of the responsibility and some of the onus is on voters to say, you own our democracy, you have to make better choices who you're hiring as executives, or do you think all of the burden is on the leadership itself?
Government by the people. Come on, people.
I know.
You're in charge of this place. Get used to it. Get real. You got to hold these people accountable and make them do the things they promised to do, right?
Right.
States and organizations and governments that have that going on are going to get something done, because now they're accountable back to those voters, back to those shareholders. The citizens need to be aware. They're really in charge.
I couldn't agree more. We talk about this all the time in the show. Our democracy is about 238 years old, and so many brave men and women back at when we emerged as we broke away from Mother England as a country, and to this very second, we have men and women defending America, defending democracy, trying to spread democratic principles around the world. And if we don't have a population, if we don't have an electorate that can take the time to learn about issues, and I'm less concerned about partisan positioning than I am about information. I'm a Democrat. I believe in democratic principles. But as long as people are informed, and I think, but people aren't as engaged. And that's one of the, I think that's one of our challenges.
So think for a moment. We ought to all be self-reliant. We ought to be people who step up and take accountability, right? But when you start to have an electorate that lives on the dole,
right,
they're going to let the government take care of them and not even say a single thing against the government, because life is good for that group. And the more and more people we have that become sort of insulated to what's really going on in the world and don't care, as long as they get the full bowl of rice, if you will, they're not going to buck the system. They're not going to challenge their government leaders who should report to them. So America started to drift away from those original founding fathers.
I agree. We have Alan Hall here in the studio. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Shifting gears a little bit before we get back to the economy and your talk. Mitt Romney. I grew up outside of Boston in the shadow of the Kennedy compound, and as a Democrat, I've been a Democrat my whole life. But I thought Mitt Romney had an interesting resume. And although I supported Barack Obama, and I still to this day support Barack Obama, if Mitt Romney had been successful, my reaction would have been, well, I may disagree with him on many philosophical but he represented something which I thought was basic competency. He seemed like a competent man. He seemed like a competent governor when he was in Massachusetts. He was competent in his oversight of the Olympics. And if he had been elected president, I don't think he would have done any radical, wild things. Why is it that you think the opposite appears to have been the case 7 years ago or 6 years ago when Barack Obama was elected? So many people on the other side of the party were like, we want him to fail. And whether it's people in Congress or general public, as opposed to collaborating and saying he's our president, whether we personally like him or not, that emotional element seems to be part of the hurdle that we're facing that hurts our economy, hurts our progress, and hurts our standing in the world.
One of the things I'm going to give in my talk is about people coming together, debating options, making decisions, and then everybody rallying around. We're going to all move forward together.
Right. Was I right about Mitt Romney, by the way? He's from your very
special. Yeah, you know, when I was one of his campaign chairs raising money in the state of Utah, we raised a lot of money for him. And my bias is, obviously because I'm a business guy, is that he would come in and run government like a businessman would, right? But at the end,
aside from the picture when he had all the $20 bills stuffing out of his pants and his shirt, when it was, you know, he was a venture capitalist. But I agree that he had elements of competency which I could have supported. And if he was our president, I wouldn't have woken up every morning going, I want him to fail, and what can I do to make him fail? I would have been, it's my interest and our interest for him to succeed. But it doesn't feel like we've had that for the last 6 years. It feels like there's a big group of people that are more focused on how can we trip up this administration and make him succeed.
Well, Steve, that is what's happening, and you see sort of what boat we're in.
Right.
We have gridlock. We're just not moving forward on a lot of things we ought to be taking care of.
Are those business issues, political issues, or is it the psychology of the time? I mean, we're in what, aside from the last 5 years, there was certainly economic crisis, in general, the last 30 or 40 years is one of the most prosperous periods, or the most prosperous period in American history. And in some ways, and you come from a marketing background, in some ways we've over-marketed, or many people think we over-marketed to individuals where everyone has a sense of, I don't want to say it's narcissism or hedonism, but everyone has a sense of this personal right to be special and have a special iPhone and a special car, and we all need 50-inch screen TVs, and government should do this, and we are, as opposed to working hard and having some, you know, what I refer to as President Kennedy's famous speech during, I think it was his first inaugural, saying, don't ask what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. It feels like we've lost that. And so I don't know if it's a business thing, a political thing, or has our human nature changed where people aren't geared towards sacrifice or commitment or patriotism or something like that?
Well, I think you've summarized, and I'll kind of give you some color on it. I think we've become an entitled society. We think we deserve it. We think we have the right to have anything we ask for. We've become a little more selfish. We really don't think beyond our own needs and wishes. And when that happens in a society, it's the general decline of the society, because now people aren't thinking out beyond their own lives. And in America today, we ought to be thinking broadly about the common good, not just how good it's going to be for me.
Well, that's something that the parallel to the Roman Empire. I'm not suggesting that we're about to fall over, but would you mind talking about pay inequality? You know, you, looking at your resume and your background, you've been successful in business, and from looking at your background, you're starting the Peace Corps. I will stipulate that it's come from hard work and commitment and sacrifice on your part. It's put you in a position where you're an entrepreneur, an angel investor, venture capitalist because of hard work. But one of the elements that is both a reality and also has become kind of pervasive in the political world now is the sense of pay inequality, that the ratio between the highest of us, the CEOs, the range between people who are doing the bulk of the work and then the people who have the fancy titles, that range has gotten far more drastic than any other time in our history, and that it purports to have dire consequence. It's unsustainable. And first of all, do you have a thought on pay inequality and what it means for society and where we are with it today?
So I'll give you a couple of thoughts. One is I have worked hard all my life. It's not been easy, and I've risked, and I've lost, and I've, if you add up all my losses, and now you add up my gains, I'm a little ahead. So if people really start to look at guys like me who make a lot of money, you have to look at it in the net effect and the risk I took.
Right.
Does that make sense?
I used to live in a double-wide trailer in Beaumont, Texas years ago, so I'm right there with you.
You get the point, right?
Right.
I want to make sure all of my employees, though, are paid a marketable wage so they could go anywhere. It's certainly a right for them to take employment anywhere. I want to make sure that they're rewarded sufficiently, but they don't take the risk. And risk and reward then equates in terms of what wage equality means for me, right?
Right.
So it means if I'm putting all the risk, I'm second mortgage in my house, and I'm doing everything to make that happen, I don't think that employee should enjoy the upside that I do if I make it happen because of the risk I took. And of course, over the long term, the risks were pretty severe, and the loss of money to me was amazingly high, right? But do I believe America should pay people exactly what they're worth? Should that be a marketable wage? Yes. But that sort of gets back to this inequality thing and back to entitlement for me. So if somebody in my employ thinks that they should be making as much money as I do because they do a good job every day, I'm thinking, well, show me your value that gives you that sort of an income.
Well, but I think part of the argument, though, Alan, is that it's not so much making the same amount, but being, you know, the devil is in the details, being within a certain ratio or certain range. And, back in the 50s and 60s, I don't know if it was 100 to 1 or 80 to 1 in the auto industry and when Henry Ford's thought about how much he should get paid versus people on the line. But I think the part of the argument is that when you have, whether it's during Roman times or the last 20 years, when you have a ruling class, whether that's a ruling political class or an economic class of people that are doing well, ascending to the stratosphere where they're making the policy, it's a little bit like that class is not only enjoying the benefit of their status, but they're the ones making the rules, reinforcing the rules, changing the rules, and in some ways potentially tilting the game, because when they get together, they say, this seems like a reasonable rule. And whether that has to do with tax policy or whether that has to do with any other, and then if, with how that ties into elections and how much money can be put into elections and clean elections and Citizen United, there's a feeling in the country now, and the feeling feels pretty pervasive, and that is, well, the whether they're one percenters or half a percenters or whatever the term is, the folks who are really benefiting the most aren't just benefiting, they're changing and creating rules that both perpetuates and extends those benefits and further keeps other people down below. Do you think that's a valid concern or observation?
No, I think I'm not in favor of that. Matter of fact, if you really look at what we do with our money, we give most of it away, right? My wages that I make now, I give away. Now, I give it to people who really need that extra right. amount of money for food or housing or whatever it is. But when you find a cabal of people who basically are greedy and want to keep the game and want to have a monopoly on the game, I'm not in favor of that. That's wrong, right? But do we legislate against them, or do we just let them fall on their own virtue sword? Or what is it that takes place in a capitalistic society versus government coming in and mandating we're going to redistribute your money? So it's not – capitalism isn't perfect by any means, but you would hope most of the people who are going to lead businesses and run them – and I think most of the companies in the United States, except for some of these very large ones, most company owners, just like yourself, they're good people. They're good men and women who are out there trying to do their best with their employees. You've got this maybe small piece of America that's really out of whack, but most of American businesses, most people who run these wonderful businesses aren't bad people.
Oh, I agree. Right? And from your work that I've read about as a philanthropist, and same thing with like Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation mm-hmm. and Warren Buffett, mm-hmm. obviously there's a group of people that have been successful, and they're also very thoughtful, and they're conscientious. But when you look at the statistics showing at the disparity of wealth and the range is growing, you can either attribute that to some sort of natural evolution, or there's evidence to suggest that if the people who control the game are also making rules for the game, and they're the ones judging the game, literally and figuratively through the judicial system and through legislative process, the people who are outside of the game, at some point, they want to bang down the walls and say, hey, this isn't literally or figuratively. They bang down the walls and say, you know, we're starving out here. And what do you think about minimum wage as opposed to that being one key measurement relative to income? And the President Obama has suggested that 10-10, the federal standard, be expanded. Do you think government should be active in that area, or do you think that there's natural ebb and flow that should be decided state by state?
Yeah, I think it goes back to the ethics of people. But let's look at Walmart. Let's look at McDonald's. Let's look at places where you work for a minimum wage and you really can't survive.
Right.
You're really below the poverty level.
Well, you can, but then the government programs have to subsidize we're paying that extra amount.
You do. So if you and I and we're in a position where we're running those two large organizations and you and I have got employees that have to have a second job because ours doesn't take care of them, shame on us. Let's pay them enough so they've got a full week's wages, monthly wage, yearly wages, right, where they've got a livable wage. Shame on us. You and I could fix that tomorrow, but corporate America has a different way. It's about nothing about profits, profits, profits. It's about greed within our society. And you know what? You and I who are investors, we perpetuate the greed of corporations because what do we want? We want more profits coming in so our stock price goes up. So we're really enabling, if you think about it, the behavior of corporations through our view of what value we want out of our stocks. Therefore, the corporation looks at it and says, let's keep our wages low. And we'll keep them just low enough where people stay, we'll keep them, and there'll be some attrition. But if they don't stay, we'll get a whole new batch of people. So it's sort of a wicked cycle that all of us in one for a number participate in.
But doesn't that demand government to step in? Because if it can't be self-regulated, I think $7.40 or 70 cents is not a livable rate. You know, people debate it around the country. People can say, oh, no, it's an entry portal. I believe 10-10. So as a business owner, I've made the decision over the last year, and we've done this for many years, but we've memorialized it this year, not to pay a single person less than that, whether they're an intern, whether they're somebody working in the warehouse. But if Walmart doesn't make that same decision, or McDonald's or any large employer, and they say, nope, that's not to the benefit of our shareholders, don't you think it's appropriate for the government to say, well, you know, that's not a natural mechanism? Or do you believe that government should have its role, and that, you know, business and capitalism should seek its own level on its own?
Well, I'm not for government telling me how to run my business. I think that really bugs me to no end, to have them set policy. Now, I get it on the humanitarian side, but I'd rather let the markets adjust accordingly. So if I've got an employee that's really not doing well, and they need to potentially go find a different job where they make more, go for it. But I don't like the idea of government coming in, because if they'll come in on that, what else will they come in on? Well, we already know. They're coming in on other things that I don't agree with.
Yeah, I mean, I'm torn with that. You know, earlier today, I think I mentioned to you, I interviewed Senator George Mitchell, who was involved both with Senator Muskie and his own work in terms of Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act. Over my lifetime, I've witnessed in the early 60s, Ralph Nader was, for most businesses, they probably thought he was a pain in the butt.
Yeah.
But when you look at, with what he did in the auto industry, whether it was with seatbelts, whether it was shoulder harness, whether it was with the Corvair, whether it was airbags, at every point in almost every industry, industry pushes back, right? So the entire auto industry, when airbags were being proposed, I don't know if it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, the industry said, no, no, no. If you do that, you will bankrupt the auto industry. We'll have to fire people. And at some point, the government had to say, you know what? We're going to do this. Same thing with clean air, clean water standards. At every point when the government said, hey, we're thinking about doing these restrictive smokestack, air filter systems, power generation plants and factories said, okay, you're going to put us out of business. But you know what? If it's the right policy rooted in the right principles, and it's not onerous, but same thing with food and drugs, same thing with food quality. So I am always a little bit leery when business pushes back and people say, oh, the reflex, oh, we can't do this too much to business. Because if we leave it up to business, I think we've seen what can happen historically, and that, we should incorporate business's feeling, but the idea of, oh, business doesn't like this, or Walmart would be uncomfortable if we raise minimum wage. Part of me wants to say, well, let's incorporate their thinking, but policy is something different.
You're making a really interesting point here about how government intervenes to do things for common good.
Right.
And I get that. Companies will always do the following. Government comes in and says, you're going to have to put airbags in, or you're going to have to do this, you're going to have to do that. And we then, as corporate heads, do the following. We increase our prices to cover our costs so we maintain our profitability. So the buyers of our products and services, now we're going to pay a higher premium for those things. So we pass, if you will, that financial responsibility onto our marketplace in one form or another. Whether government chooses to do it or not, that's exactly what we do. Because our shareholders want profitability and a growing stock price. So it's all one sort of one big circle, right? I believe the government's role is for the common good, to make sure we protect each other. Nothing wrong with that whatsoever. I'm in favor of that.
Well, but I think it's also to create a level playing field. I mean, I don't want government to get involved with my business and make decisions on, winners and losers, that type of thing. But I think government's role is to ensure, whether it's the financial industry, which was really the genesis for this crisis over the last 5 years, it was the Wild West. And I don't think but a handful of people ever went to prison or were fined. 8 or 10 years ago, Martha Stewart went to prison for like insider trading $30,000 worth of some crazy stock. So, little old Martha Stewart goes to jail because her stockbroker called her up and gave her a tip, and she sold like $30,000 worth of some, I think it was some tech stock. Meanwhile, Lehman Brothers and Solomon and Countrywide are doing crazy financial things, overextending themselves, backed by the Fed. And everyone just kind of throws their hands up and go, well, yeah, I guess that was a mistake. But yet the billionaires become multi-billionaires. And ultimately, the citizens, through tax rates, through bigger, it just feels like it always trickles down. And I'm looking for some way, for government not to overextend itself, but to create a level playing field. So whether it's the financial markets, whether it's involving technology, which is a big deal now in terms of internet speed, which will be have huge economic consequences in terms of FCC decisions about broadband spectrums and satellite stuff. I don't want the government to decide which company is going to win or lose, but I do want the government as the impartial party to say, this is what's best for the common good, and ultimately this is fair. And I don't know if that happens every day.
Well, it obviously doesn't, right? I mean, it's a part of capitalism today as people are getting away with murder and others are trying to do the best they can. And think how many companies fail every year. In venture capital alone, obviously where I spend a lot of my time, 2,000 venture capitalist companies or funds were available about 5 years ago. It's down by 1,000. Half are gone.
Wow.
Half are gone.
And why is that? Because it's a more risky environment? Because of what's the variable there? It's
high risk. They put money into deals that didn't pan out, and now they're gone. Their shareholders, their limited partners all lost their money. Companies are gone. The employees, those managers are gone. So capitalism has a way over the course of time to sort of level it out. It's not one of those things where you can level it out in a season or in a year or even a couple of years. It's something that required the dynamics of an enormous economy, which is the United States and the global economy, which is all connected together, to provide the leveling out, because people are going to win and lose by the very nature of how they perform in their marketplace.
By the way, we have Alan Hall in the studio. He's an entrepreneur, an angel investor, venture capitalist, author, philanthropist. He is also a contributor to Forbes.com. Former CEO of MarketStar, current chairman, and he is in Maine this week speaking, giving a presentation to the Moreta Group, talking about Utah's economy, which is, by all measure, more vibrant than Maine's, and talking about some things Maine can do differently. In our last couple of minutes, Alan, can you talk a little bit about, you talk about the pillars of a high-growth economy, and can you kind of detail what you believe those pillars are and how they may be applicable here in Maine?
Well, yeah, I've got a little list here. I can't memorize all 10 of them.
Sure.
Look at my cheat sheet here for a minute just to make sure. But I think the great pillars of high growth are you have a government, a local government, state government that's business-friendly, which means taxes and regulations around business. And if they're supportive of the businesses that are here and the ones they're trying to attract, that's probably the first one. You have to have a very large, abundant, educated workforce.
Right.
And in the state of Maine right now, we have a shrinking number of people, and we have an age group that's really probably 40 to 50 years of age. Utah, on the other hand, the average age is 29.
Yeah, we have the oldest age population in the country. And the big problem is we're not putting anything in the drinking water. I don't want you to be nervous drinking the water here like you're going to magically age when you go back to Utah. We're losing 18 to 34 people. So it's not that it's not like Florida where we're importing people. A lot of older people retire to Florida. That's not how Maine ends up the oldest state. It's we are losing the most vibrant and dynamic and age group, because we don't have, in my mind, both the opportunity and the infrastructure that people, a lot of people, 18 to 34, really want where they live and where they want to find a job.
And yet you have one of the more beautiful states in the country.
The most beautiful. Don't even say one of the most beautiful. I know you're partial to Utah, but I think we have the most beautiful state in the
world. We don't have trees. We just have red rocks. You have lots of beautiful green things and water. And
Utah's,
you know,
beautiful, too.
You and I were governor, I'd say, we got to keep these kids here.
Right.
And we've got to have an economy and a government that makes it attractive to start and grow and attract business. We've got to do that to keep our kids here.
Right.
Period.
What are the other pillars that we're missing here?
Well,
the
other one I think is important back to business and lower costs is when it comes to water, energy, transportation, things of that sort, it's got to be inexpensive. You've got to provide these things to these companies who are coming in and need those resources, and it has to be fairly inexpensive. And in Utah, we're 29% less than anywhere else in the United States. Our costs of doing business are that low for companies coming to Utah. So the government's got to look at how do we make these things inexpensive. That's a big pillar. You have to have financial institutions who are willing to help and take a risk with these companies that are here and provide them with the funds to grow. Quality of life, obviously, is huge. Innovation. if you don't innovate, if you don't change, you're going to be gone. And so I look at state governments, I look at education, I look at healthcare, I look at all these sort of old sorts of institutions that if they don't become innovative and look to their new customer base and how they're going to change, they'll just be out of business. States can be out of business.
You need to highlight that tomorrow on your note there.
Yep.
Because I think that, you know, again, Maine has a great legacy and is one of the oldest states. Having the deep roots have been great in many areas of Maine, but relative to new economy and relative to economic opportunity, I believe we need to, you know, spend more time looking forward than backwards. And Maine, I think, has been challenged sometimes with that.
So let me give you a really interesting perspective. Property. We all value it. We like to own it, don't we?
Sure.
And Maine and most states have all been based upon real property, land, buildings. But it's limited. Now, let me talk about intellectual property, which is unlimited. And anybody can develop it. So think of a state that moves from our wonderful pieces of property, earth, the dirt, the water, and let's now encourage our youth and people to come to our state who come up with new intellectual properties, which have huge value, and you hire a lot of people to roll out those wonderful new ideas, right?
Right.
It's a paradigm shift of where you go from dirt to something you can't touch. Revenue growth opportunities. I'm thinking of import-export or exports in this particular case. You've got great things you can export out of the state, but what more could you export? And how would you find industries and companies that could start to have these things sold globally over the internet or otherwise? It's a big part of your growth, having the ability to grow. And lastly, having anchor sort of industries. Who do we have? And do we need to attract new anchor companies to the state, and what would they be, and how do we get them here, and how do we incentivize them? Well, it goes back to that very first one. We better have a business-friendly state.
Alan, we're running out of time, but I'd love to have you come back sometime. I think it's great that you're visiting Maine and you're sharing some of your insights, and thank you so much for being with us.
Steve, my pleasure. Let's do it.
Well, let's definitely do it. Maybe the next time I'll go to Utah.
We'll do the interview there.
We will do the interview there. We will cross-pollinate these great ideas, and we'll go from there. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
We've had Alan Hall here. He is in town to speak at the Moreta Group, contributor to Forbes, successful business entrepreneur. And you've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. We'll be back.